This is Audible.
Simon & Schuster Audio presents Mr. Mercedes by Stephen King. Read by Will Patton.
Thinking of James M. Kane. They threw me off the hay truck about noon. Gray Mercedes. April 9 through 10, 2009. Augie Odenkirk had a 1997 Datsun that still ran well in spite of high mileage, but gas was expensive, especially for a man with no job, and city center was on the far side of town, so he decided to take the last bus of the night. He got off at 20 past 11 with his pack on his back and his rolled-up sleeping bag under one arm. He thought he would be glad of the down-filled bag by 3 a.m. The night was misty and chill. "Good luck, man," the driver said as he stepped down. "You ought to get something for just being the first one there." Only he wasn't. When Augie reached the top of the wide, steep drive leading to the big auditorium, he saw a cluster of at least 2 dozen people already waiting outside the rank of doors, some standing, most sitting. Posts strung with yellow "Do Not Cross" tape had been set up, creating a complicated passage that doubled back on itself, maze-like. Augie was familiar with these from movie theaters and the bank where he was currently overdrawn and understood the purpose, to cram as many people as possible into as small a space as possible. As he approached the end of what would soon be a conga line of job applicants, Augie was both amazed and dismayed to see that the woman at the end of the line had a sleeping baby in a papoose carrier. The baby's cheeks were flushed with the cold. Each exhale came with a faint rattle. The woman heard Augie's slightly out of breath approach and turned. She was young and pretty enough, even with the dark circles under her eyes. At her feet was a small quilted carry case. Augie supposed it was a baby support system. "Hi," she said. "Welcome to the Early Birds Club." "Hopefully we'll catch a worm," he debated, thought what the hell, and stuck out his hand. "August Odenkirk. Augie. I was recently downsized. That's the 21st century way of saying I got canned." She shook with him. She had a good grip, firm and not a bit timid. "I'm Janice Cray, and my little bundle of joy is Patty. I guess I got downsized too. I was a housekeeper for a nice family in Sugar Heights. He, owns a car dealership." Augie winced. Janice nodded. "I know. He said he was sorry to let me go, but they had to tighten their belts." "A lot of that going around," Augie said, thinking. "You could find no one to babysit? No one at all?" "I had to bring her." He supposed Janice Cray didn't have to be much of a mind reader to know what he was thinking. "There's no one else. Literally no one. The girl down the street couldn't stay all night even if I could pay her, and I just can't. If I don't get a job, I don't know what we'll do." "Your parents couldn't take her?" Augie asked. "They live in Vermont. If I had half a brain, I'd take Patty and go there. It's pretty. Only they've got their own problems. Dad says their house is underwater. Not literally. They're not in the river or anything. It's something financial." Augie nodded. There was a lot of that going around, too. A few cars were coming up the steep rise from Marlborough Street where Augie had gotten off the bus. They turned left into the vast, empty plain of parking lot that would no doubt be full by daylight tomorrow, still hours before the first annual city job fair opened its doors. None of the cars looked new. Their drivers parked, and from most of them, 3 or 4 job seekers emerged, heading toward the doors of the auditorium. Augie was no longer at the end of the line. It had almost reached the first switchback. If I can get a job, I can get a sitter, she said. But for tonight, me and Patty just gotta suck it up. The baby gave a croupy cough Augie didn't care for, stirred in the papoose, and then settled again. At least the kid was bundled up. There were even tiny mittens on her hands. Kids survive worse, Augie told himself uneasily. He thought of the Dust Bowl and the Great Depression. Well, this one was great enough for him. 2 years ago, everything had been fine. He hadn't exactly been living large in the hood, but he had been making ends meet with a little left over at the end of most months. Now everything had turned to shit. They had done something to the money. He didn't understand it. He'd been an office drone in the shipping department of Great Lakes Transport, and what he knew about was invoices and using a computer to route stuff by ship, train, and air. People will see me with a baby and think I'm irresponsible, Janice Cray fretted. I know it. I see it on their faces already. I saw it on yours. But what else could I do? Even if the girl down the street could stay all night, it would have cost $84. 84. I've got next month's rent put aside, and after that I'm skint. She smiled, and in the light of the parking lot's high-arc sodiums, Augie saw tears beading her eyelashes. I'm babbling. No need to apologize if that's what you're doing. The line had turned the first corner now and had arrived back at where Augie was standing. And the girl was right. He saw lots of people staring at the sleeping kid in the papoose. Oh, that's it, all right. I'm a single, unmarried mother with no job. I want to apologize to everyone for everything. She turned and looked at the banner posted above the rank of doors. 1,000 jobs guaranteed, it read. And below that, we stand with the people of our city. Mayor Ralph Kinsler. Sometimes I want to apologize for Columbine and 9/11 and Barry Bonds taking steroids. She uttered a semi-hysterical giggle. Sometimes I even want to apologize for the space shuttle exploding, and when that happened, I was still learning to walk. Don't worry, Augie told her. You'll be okay. It was just one of those things that you said. I wish it wasn't so damp, that's all. I've got her bundled up in case it was really cold, but this damp. She shook her head. We'll make it, though, won't we, Patty? She gave Augie a hopeless little smile. It just better not rain. It didn't, but the dampness increased until they could see fine droplets suspended in the light thrown by the arc sodiums. At some point, Augie realized that Janice Cray was asleep on her feet. She was hip-shot and slump-shouldered, with her hair hanging in dank wings around her face and her chin nearly on her breastbone. He looked at his watch and saw it was 2:45. 10 minutes later, Patty Cray awoke and started to cry. Her mother, her baby mama, Augie thought, gave a jerk, voiced a horse-like snort, raised her head and tried to pull the infant out of the papoose. At first the kid wouldn't come, her legs were stuck. Augie pitched in, holding the sides of the sling. As Patty emerged now wailing, he could see drops of water sparkling all over her tiny pink jacket and matching hat. She's hungry, Janice said. I can give her the breast, but she's also wet. I can feel it right through her pants. God, I can't change her in this. Look how foggy it's gotten. Augie wondered what comical deity had arranged for him to be the one in line behind her. He also wondered how in hell this woman was going to get through the rest of her life. All of it, not just the next 18 years or so when she would be responsible for the kid. To come out on a night like this, with nothing but a bag of diapers, to be that goddamn desperate. He had put his sleeping bag down next to Patty's diaper bag. Now he squatted, pulled the ties, unrolled it, and unzipped it. Slide in there, get warm and get her warm, then I'll hand in whatever doodads you need. She gazed at him, holding the squirming, crying baby. Are you married, Augie? Divorced. Children? He shook his head. Why are you being so kind to us? Because we're here, he said, and shrugged. She looked at him a moment longer, deciding, then handed him the baby. Augie held her out at arm's length, fascinated by the red, furious face, the bead of snot on the tiny upturned nose, the bicycling legs in the flannel onesie. Janice squirmed into the sleeping bag, then lifted her hands. Give her to me, please. Augie did, and the woman burrowed deeper into the bag. Beside them, where the line had doubled back on itself for the first time, two young men were staring. "Mind your business, guys," Augie said, and they looked away. "Would you give me a diaper?" Janice said. "I should change her before I feed her." He dropped one knee to the wet pavement and unzipped the quilted bag. He was momentarily surprised to find cloth diapers instead of Pampers, then understood. The cloth ones could be used over and over. Maybe the woman wasn't entirely hopeless. "I see a bottle of baby magic, too. Do you want that?" From inside the sleeping bag, where now only a tuft of her brownish hair showed, "Yes, please." He passed in the diaper and the lotion. The sleeping bag began to wiggle and bounce. At first, the crying intensified. From one of the switchbacks farther down, lost in the thickening fog, someone said, "Can't you shut that kid up?" Another voice added, "Someone ought to call social services." Augie waited, watching the sleeping bag. At last it stopped moving around and a hand emerged holding a diaper. "Would you put it in the bag? There's a plastic sack for the dirty ones." She looked out at him like a mole from its hole. "Don't worry, it's not pooey, just wet." Augie took the diaper, put it in the plastic bag, Costco printed on the side, then zipped the diaper bag closed. The crying from inside the sleeping bag, "So many bags," he thought, continued for another minute or so, then abruptly cut out as Patty began to nurse in the city center parking lot. From above the rank doors that wouldn't open for another 6 hours, the banner gave a single, lackadaisical flap. 1,000 jobs guaranteed. Sure, Augie thought. Also, you can't catch AIDS if you load up on vitamin C. 20 minutes passed. More cars came up the hill from Marlboro Street. More people joined the line. Augie estimated there already had to be 400 people waiting. At that rate, there would be 2,000 by the time the doors opened at 9, and that was a conservative estimate. "If someone offers me fry cook at McDonald's, will I take it?" "Probably." "What about a greeter at Walmart?" "Almost deaf. Big smile, and how are you today?" Augie thought he could wallop a greeter job right out of the park. "I'm a people person," he thought, and laughed. From the bag, "What's funny?" "Nothing," he said. "Cuddle that kid." "I am." A smile in her voice. At 3:30, he knelt, lifted the flap of the sleeping bag, and peered inside. Janice Cray was curled up, fast asleep with the baby at her breast. This made him think of the Grapes of Wrath. What was the name of the girl who had been in it, the one who ended up nursing the man? A flower name, he thought. Lily? No. Pansy? Absolutely not. He thought of cupping his hands around his mouth, raising his voice, and asking the crowd, "Who here has read The Grapes of Wrath?" As he was standing up again and smiling at this absurdity, the name came to him. Rose. That had been the name of the Grapes of Wrath girl. But not just Rose. Rose of Sharon. It sounded biblical, but he couldn't say so with any certainty. He had never been a Bible reader. He looked down at the sleeping bag, in which he had expected to spend the small hours of the night, and thought of Janice Cray saying she wanted to apologize for Columbine and 9/11 and Barry Bonds. Probably she would cop to global warming as well. Maybe when this was over, and they had secured jobs, or not, not was probably just as likely, he would treat her to breakfast. Not a date, nothing like that, just some scrambled eggs and bacon. After that, they would never see each other again. More people came. They reached the end of the postage switchbacks with a self-important "Do Not Cross" tape. Once that was used up, the line began to stretch into the parking lot. What surprised Augie and made him uneasy was how silent they were, as if they all knew this mission was a failure and they were only waiting to get the official word. The banner gave another lackadaisical flap. The fog continued to thicken. Shortly before 5 a.m., Augie roused from his own half-doze, stamped his feet to wake them up, and realized an unpleasant iron light had crept into the air. It was the furthest thing in the world from the rosy-fingered dawn of poetry and old Technicolor movies, This was an anti-dawn, damp and as pale as the cheek of a day-old corpse. He could see the City Center auditorium slowly revealing itself in all its 1970s tacky architectural glory. He could see the 24 switchbacks of patiently waiting people and then the tailback of the line disappearing into the fog. Now there was a little conversation, and when a janitor clad in gray fatigues passed through the lobby on the other side of the doors, a small satiric cheer went up. "Life is discovered on other planets," shouted one of the young men who had been staring at Janice Cray. This was Keith Frias, whose left arm would shortly be torn from his body. There was mild laughter at this sally, and people began to talk. The night was over. The seeping light wasn't particularly encouraging, but it was marginally better than the long, small hours just past. Augie knelt beside his sleeping bag again and cocked an ear. The small, regular snores he heard made him smile. Maybe his worry about her had been for nothing. He guessed there were people who went through life surviving, perhaps even thriving, on the kindness of strangers. The young woman currently snoozing in his sleeping bag with her baby might be one of them. It came to him that he and Janice Cray could present themselves at the various application tables as a couple. If they did that, the baby's presence might not seem an indicator of irresponsibility, but rather of joint dedication. He couldn't say for sure. Much of human nature was a mystery to him, but he thought it was possible. He decided he'd try the idea out on Janice when she woke up. See what she thought. They couldn't claim marriage. She wasn't wearing a wedding ring, and he'd taken his off for good 3 years before, but they could claim to be, what was it people said now? Partners. Cars continued to come up the steep incline from Marlborough Street at steady tick-tock intervals. There would soon be pedestrians as well, fresh off the first bus of the morning. Augie was pretty sure they started running at 6. Because of the thick fog, the arriving cars were just headlights with vague shadow shapes lurking behind the windshields. A few of the drivers saw the huge crowd already waiting and turned around, discouraged. But most kept on, heading for the few remaining parking spaces, their taillights dwindling. Then Augie noticed a car shape that neither turned around nor continued on toward the far reaches of the parking lot. Its unusually bright headlights were flanked by yellow fog lamps. HD headers, Augie thought. That's a Mercedes-Benz. What's a Benz doing at a job fair? He supposed it might be Mayor Kinsler here to make a speech to the Early Birds Club, to congratulate them on their gumption. Their good old American get-up-and-get. If so, Augie thought, arriving in his Mercedes, even if it was an old one, was in bad taste. An elderly fellow in line ahead of Augie, Wayne Welland, now in the last moments of his earthly existence, said, "Is that a Benz? It looks like a Benz." Augie started to say, of course it was, you couldn't mistake a Mercedes HD headlamps, and then the driver of the car directly behind the vague shape laid on his horn. A long, impatient blast. The HD lights flashed brighter than ever, cutting brilliant white cones through the suspended droplets of the fog, and the car leaped forward as if the impatient horn had goosed it. "Hey," Wayne Welland said, surprised. It was his final word. The car accelerated directly at the place where the crowd of job seekers was most tightly packed and hemmed in by the do-not-cross tapes. Some of them tried to run, but only the ones at the rear of the crowd were able to break free. Those closer to the doors, the true early birds, had no chance. They struck the posts and knocked them over. They got tangled in the tapes. They rebounded off each other. The crowd swayed back and forth in a series of agitated waves. Those who were older and smaller fell down and were trampled underfoot. Augie was shoved hard to the left, stumbled, recovered, and was pushed forward. A flying elbow struck his cheekbone just below his right eye, and that side of his vision filled with bright 4th of July sparkles. From the other eye he could see the Mercedes not just emerging from the fog, but seeming to create itself from it. A big gray sedan, maybe an SL500, the kind with 12 cylinders, and right now all 12 were screaming. Augie was driven to his knees beside the sleeping bag and kicked repeatedly as he struggled to get back up. In the arm, in the shoulder, in the neck. People were screaming. He heard a woman cry, "Look out, look out, he's not stopping!" He saw Janice Cray pop her head out of the sleeping bag, eyes blinking in bewilderment. Once more he was reminded of a shy mole peering from its hole. A lady mole with a bad case of bedhead. He scrambled forward on his hands and knees and lay down on the bag and the woman and the baby inside as if by doing this he could successfully shield them from a 2-ton piece of German engineering. He heard people yelling, the sound of them almost lost beneath the approaching roar of the big sedan's motor. Someone fetched him a terrific wallop on the back of his head, but he barely felt it. There was time to think, I was going to buy Rose of Sharon breakfast. There was time to think, maybe he'll veer off. That seemed to be their best chance, probably their only chance. He started to raise his head to see if it was happening, and a huge black tire ate up his vision. He felt the woman's hand grip his forearm. He had time to hope the baby was still sleeping. Then time ran out. Det Rett. 1. Hodges walks out of the kitchen with a can of beer in his hand, sits down in a lazy boy, and puts the can down on a little table to his left next to the gun. It's a .38 Smith & Wesson M&P revolver, M&P standing for military and police. He pats it absently, the way you'd pat an old dog, then picks up the remote control and turns on Channel 7. He's a little late, and the studio audience is already applauding. He's thinking of a fad, brief and baleful, that inhabited the city in the late 80s. Or maybe the word he really wants is infected, because it had been like a transient fever. The city's three papers had written editorials about it all one summer. Now two of those papers are gone, and the third is on life support. The host comes striding on stage in a sharp suit, waving to the audience. Hodges has watched this show almost every weekday since his retirement from the police force, and he thinks this man is too bright to be doing this job, one that's a little like scuba diving in a sewer without a wetsuit. He thinks the host is the sort of man who sometimes commits suicide, and afterward all his friends and close relatives say they never had a clue anything was wrong. They talk about how cheerful he was the last time they saw him. At this thought, Hodges gives the revolver another absent pat. It is the Victory model, an oldie but a goodie. His own gun, when he was active, was a Glock 40. He bought it. Officers in this city are expected to buy their service weapons, and now it's in the safe in his bedroom. Safe in the safe. He unloaded it and put it in there after the retirement ceremony and hasn't looked at it since. No interest. He likes the .38, though. He has a sentimental attachment to it. But there's something beyond that. A revolver never jams. Here is the first guest, a young woman in a short blue dress. Her face is a trifle on the vacant side, but she's got a knockout bod. Somewhere inside that dress, Hodges knows, there will be the sort of tattoo now referred to as a tramp stamp. Maybe two or three. The men in the audience whistle and stomp their feet. The women in the audience applaud more gently. Some roll their eyes. This is the kind of woman you don't like to catch your husband staring at. The woman is pissed right from go. She tells the host that her boyfriend has had a baby with another woman and he goes over to see them all the time. She still loves him, she says. But she hates that. The next couple of words are bleeped out, but Hodges can lip read fucking horror. The audience cheers. Hodges takes a sip of his beer. He knows what comes next. This show has all the predictability of a soap opera on Friday afternoon. The host lets her run on for a bit and then introduces the other woman. She also has a knockout bod and several yards of big blonde hair. There's a tramp stamp on one ankle. She approaches the other woman and says, "I understand how you feel, but I love him too." She's got more on her mind, but that's as far as she gets before Knockout Bod 1 goes into action. Someone off stage rings a bell as if this were the start of a prize fight. Hodges supposes it is, since all the guests on the show must be compensated. Why else would they do it? The two women punch and claw for a few seconds, and then the two beefcakes with security printed on their t-shirts who have been watching from the background separate them. They shout at each other for a while, a full and fair exchange of views, much of it bleeped out, as the host watches benignly. And this time it's Knockout Bod 2 who initiates the fight, swinging a big roundhouse slap that rocks Knockout Bod 1's head back. The bell rings again. They fall to the stage, their dresses rucking up, clawing and punching and slapping. The audience goes bug shit. The security beefcakes separate them, and the host gets between them, talking in a voice that is soothing on top, insightful beneath. The two women declare the depth of their love, spitting it into each other's faces. The host says they'll be right back, and then a C-list actress is selling a diet pill. Hodges takes another sip of his beer and knows he won't even finish half the can. It's funny, because when he was on the Cops, he was damn near an alcoholic. When the drinking broke up his marriage, he assumed he was an alcoholic. He summoned all his willpower and reined it in, promising himself he would drink just as much as he goddamn wanted once he had his 40 in, a pretty amazing number when 50% of city cops retired after 25 and 70% after 30. Only now that he has his 40, alcohol no longer interests him much. He forced himself to get drunk a few times just to see if he could still do it, and he could. But being drunk turned out to be no better than being sober. Actually, it was a little worse. The show returns. The host says he has another guest, and Hodges knows who that will be. The audience does, too. They yap their anticipation. Hodges picks up his father's gun, looks into the barrel, and puts it back down on the DirecTV guide. The man over whom Knockout Bod 1 and Knockout Bod 2 are in such strenuous conflict emerges from stage right. You knew what he was going to look like even before he comes strutting out and, yup, he's the guy. A gas station attendant or a Target warehouse carton shuffler or maybe the fella who detailed your car badly at the Mr. Speedy. He's skinny and pale, with black hair clumping over his forehead. He's wearing chinos and a crazy green and yellow tie that has a chokehold on his throat just below his prominent Adam's apple. The pointy toes of suede boots poke out beneath his pants. You knew that the women had tramp stamps, and you know this man is hung like a horse and shoots sperm more powerful than a locomotive and faster than a speeding bullet. A virginal maid who sits on a toilet seat after this guy jerked off will get up pregnant, probably with twins. On his face is the half-smart grin of a cool dude in a loose mood. Dream job, lifetime disability. Soon the bell will ring and the women will go at each other again. Later, after they have heard enough of his smack, they will look at each other, nod slightly, and attack him together. This time, the security personnel will wait a little longer because this final battle is what the audience, both in the studio and at home, really wants to see. The hens going after the rooster. That brief and baleful fad in the late 80s, the infection, was called bum fighting. Some gutter genius or other got the idea, and when it turned a profit, three or four other entrepreneurs leaped in to refine the deal. What you did was pay a couple of bums $30 each to go at each other at a set time and in a set place. The place Hodges remembered best was the service area behind a sleazy crab farm of a strip club called Bambalam, over on the east side. Once the fight card was set, you advertised, by word of mouth in those days, with widespread internet use still over the horizon, and charged spectators $20 a head. There had been better than 200 at the one Hodges and Pete Huntley had busted, most of them making odds and fading each other like mad motherfuckers. There had been women, too, some in evening dress and loaded with jewelry, watching as those two wet-brained stew-bums went at each other, flailing and kicking and falling down and getting up and yelling incoherencies. The crowd had been laughing and cheering and urging the combatants on. This show is like that. Only there are diet pills and insurance companies to fade the action, so Hodges supposes the contestants That's what they are, although the host calls them guests. Walk away with a little more than $30 and a bottle of nitrine. And there are no cops to break it up because it's all as legal as lottery tickets. When the show is over, the take-no-prisoners lady judge will show up, robed in her trademark brand of impatient righteousness, listening with barely suppressed rage to the small shit petitioners who come before her. Next up is the fat family psychologist who makes his guests cry, he calls this breaking through the wall of denial, and invites them to leave if any of them dare question his methods. Hodges thinks the fat family psychologist might have learned those methods from old KGB training videos. Hodges eats this diet of full-color shit every weekday afternoon, sitting in the lazy boy with his father's gun, the one Dad carried as a beat cop, on the table beside him. He always picks it up a few times and looks into the barrel, inspecting that round darkness. On a couple of occasions he has slid it between his lips, just to see what it feels like to have a loaded gun lying on your tongue and pointing at your palate. Getting used to it, he supposes. If I could drink successfully, I could put this off, he thinks. I could put it off for at least a year. And if I could put it off for two, the urge might pass. I might get interested in gardening, or bird watching, or even painting. Tim Quigley took up painting down in Florida, in a retirement community that was loaded with old cops. By all accounts, Quigley had really enjoyed it, and had even sold some of his work at the Venice Art Festival. Until his stroke, that was. After the stroke, he'd spent 8 or 9 months in bed, paralyzed all down his right side. No more painting for Tim Quigley. Then off he went. Booyah. The fight bell is ringing, and sure enough, both women are going after the scrawny guy in the crazy tie, painted fingernails flashing, big hair flying. Hodges reaches for the gun again, but he has no more than touched it when he hears the clack of the front door slot and the flump of the mail hitting the hall floor. Nothing of importance comes through the mail slot in these days of email and Facebook, but he gets up anyway. He'll look through it and leave his father's M&P 38 for another day. 2. When Hodges returns to his chair with a small bundle of mail, the fight show host is saying goodbye and promising his TV Land audience that tomorrow there will be midgets, whether of the physical or mental variety, he does not specify. Beside the lazy boy, there are two small plastic waste containers, one for returnable bottles and cans, the other for trash. Into the trash goes a circular from Walmart promising roll-back prices, an offer for burial insurance addressed to our favorite neighbor, an announcement that all DVDs are going to be 50% off for 1 week only at Discount Electronics, a postcard-sized plea for your important vote from a fellow running for a vacancy on the city council. There's a photograph of the candidate, and to Hodges he looks like Dr. Oberlin, the dentist who terrified him as a child. There's also a circular from Albertson's supermarket. This Hodges puts aside, covering up his father's gun for the time being, because it's loaded with coupons. The last thing appears to be an actual letter, a fairly thick one by the feel, in a business-sized envelope. It is addressed to Det K. William Hodges, Rett at 63 Harper Road. There is no return address. In the upper left-hand corner where one usually goes is his second smile face of the day's mail delivery. Only this one's not the winking Walmart rollback smiley, but rather the email emoticon of Smiley wearing dark glasses and showing his teeth. This stirs a memory, and not a good one. No, he thinks. No. But he rips the letter open so fast and hard the envelope tears and 4 typed pages spill out. Not real typing, not typewriter typing, but a computer font that looks like it. Dear Detective Hodges, the heading reads. He reaches out without looking, knocks the Albertson circular to the floor, finger walks across the revolver without even noticing it, and seizes the TV remote. He hits the kill switch, shutting up the take-no-prisoners lady judge in mid-scold, and turns his attention to the letter. 3. Dear Detective Hodges, I hope you do not mind me using your title, even though you have been retired for 6 months. I feel that if incompetent judges, venal politicians, and stupid military commanders can keep their titles after retirement, the same should be true for one of the most decorated police officers in the city's history. So Detective Hodges it shall be. Sir, another title you deserve, for you are a true knight of the badge and gun. I write for many reasons, but must begin by congratulating you on your years of service. 27 as a detective, and 40 in all. I saw some of the retirement ceremony on TV, Public Access Channel 2, a resource overlooked by many, and happened to know there was a party at the Raintree Inn out by the airport the following night. I bet that was the real retirement ceremony. I have certainly never attended such a bash, but I watch a lot of TV cop shows. And while I am sure many of them present a very fictional picture of the policeman's lot, several have shown such retirement parties. NYPD Blue, Homicide, The Wire, etc., etc. And I like to think they are accurate portrayals of how the Knights of the Badge and Gun say so long to one of their compatriots. I think they might be, because I have also read retirement party scenes in at least 2 Joseph Wambaugh books, and they are similar. He should know because he, like you, is a debt-ret. I imagine balloons hanging from the ceiling, a lot of drinking, a lot of bawdy conversation, and plenty of reminiscing about the old days and the old cases. There is probably lots of loud and happy music, and possibly a stripper or two, shaking her tail feathers. There are probably speeches that are a lot funnier and a lot truer than the ones at the stuffed shirt ceremony. How am I doing? Not bad, Hodges thinks. Not bad at all. According to my research, during your time as a detective, you broke literally hundreds of cases, many of them the kind the press, who Ted Williams called the Knights of the Keyboard, terms high profile. You have caught killers and robbery gangs and arsonists and rapists. In one article, published to coincide with your retirement ceremony, your longtime partner, Detective First Grade Peter Huntley, described you as a combination of by the book and intuitively brilliant. A nice compliment. If it is true, and I think it is, you will have figured out by now that I am one of those few you did not catch. I am, in fact, the man the press chose to call A. the Joker, B. the Clown, or C. the Mercedes Killer. I prefer the last. I am sure you gave it your best shot, but sadly, for you, not me, you failed. I imagine if there was ever a perk you wanted to catch, Detective Hodges, it was the man who deliberately drove into the job fair crowd at City Center last year, killing 8 and wounding so many more. I must say I exceeded my own wildest expectations. Was I on your mind when they gave you that plaque at the official retirement ceremony? Was I on your mind when your fellow Knights of the Badge and Gun were telling stories about, just guessing here, criminals who were caught with their pants actually down, or funny practical jokes that were played in the good old squad room? I bet I was. I have to tell you how much fun it was, I'm being honest here, when I put the pedal to the metal and drove poor Mrs. Olivia Trelawney's Mercedes at that crowd of people. I had the biggest hard-on of my life. And was my heart beating 200 a minute? Hope to tell ya. Here was another Mr. Smiley in sunglasses. I'll tell you something that's true inside dope. And if you want to laugh, go ahead, because it is sort of funny, although I think it also shows just how careful I was. I was wearing a condom. A rubber. Because I was afraid of spontaneous ejaculation and the DNA that might result. Well, that did not happen. But I have masturbated many times since while thinking of how they tried to run and couldn't. They were packed in like sardines. And how scared they all looked. That was so funny. And the way I jerked forward when the car plowed into them. So hard the seatbelt locked. Gosh, it was exciting. To tell the truth, I didn't know what might happen. I thought the chances were 50-50 that I would get caught. But I am a cockeyed optimist, and I prepared for success rather than failure. The condom is inside dope. But I bet your forensics department, I also watch CSI, was pretty darn disappointed when they didn't get any DNA from inside the clown mask. They must have said, "Damn, that crafty perk must have been wearing a hairnet underneath." And so I was. I also washed it out with bleach. I still relive the thuds that resulted from hitting them, and the crunching noises, and the way the car bounced on its springs when it went over the bodies. For power and control, give me a Mercedes 12-cylinder every time. When I saw in the paper that a baby was one of my victims, I was delighted. To snuff out a life that young. Think of all she missed, eh? Patricia Cray, R.I.P. Got the mom, too, strawberry jam in a sleeping bag. What a thrill, eh? I also enjoy thinking of the man who lost his arm, and even more of the two who were paralyzed. The man only from the waist down, but Martine Stover is now your basic head on a stick. They didn't die, but probably wish they did. How about that, Detective Hodges? Now, you are probably thinking, what kind of sick and twisted pervo do we have here? Can't really blame you, but we could argue about that. I think a great many people would enjoy doing what I did, and that is why they enjoy books and movies, and even TV shows these days, that feature torture and dismemberment, etc., etc., etc. The only difference is, I really did it. Not because I'm mad, though, in either sense of the word. Just because I didn't know exactly what the experience would be like, only that it would be totally thrilling, with memories to last a lifetime, as they say. Most people are fitted with lead boots when they are just little kids and have to wear them all their lives. These lead boots are called a conscience. I have none. So I can soar high above the heads of the normal crowd. And if they had caught me, well, if it had been right there, if Mrs. Trelawney's Mercedes had stalled or something, small chance of that, as it seemed very well maintained, I suppose the crowd might have torn me apart. I understood that possibility going in, and it added to the excitement. But I didn't think they really would, because most people are sheep. And sheep don't eat meat. I suppose I might have been beaten up a little, but I can take a beating. Probably I would have been arrested and gone to trial where I would have pleaded insanity. Maybe I even am insane. The idea has certainly crossed my mind. But it is a peculiar kind of insanity. Anyway, the coin came down heads and I got away. The fog helped. Now here's something else I saw, this time in a movie. I don't remember the name. There was a serial killer who was very clever, and at first the cops, one was Bruce Willis back when he still had some hair, couldn't catch him. So Bruce Willis said, he'll do it again because he can't help himself, and sooner or later he'll make a mistake and we will catch him. Which they did. That is not true in my case, Detective Hodges, because I have absolutely no urge to do it again. In my case, once was enough. I have my memories and they are as clear as a bell. And of course, There was how frightened people were afterward because they were sure I would do it again. Remember the public gatherings that were canceled? That wasn't as much fun, but it was très amusant. So you see, we are both Rhett. Speaking of which, my one regret is that I couldn't attend your retirement party at the Rain Tree Inn and raise a toast to you, my good sir detective. You absolutely did give it your best shot. Detective Huntley, too, of course, but if the papers and internet reports of your respective careers are right, you were Major League and he was and always will be Triple A. I am sure the case is still in the active file and that he takes those old reports out every now and then to study them, but he won't get anywhere. I think we both know that. May I close on a note of concern? In some of those TV shows, and also in one of the Wambaugh books, I think, but it might have been a James Patterson, the big party with the balloons and drinking and music is followed by a sad final scene. The detective goes home and finds out that without his gun and badge, his life is pointless. Which I can understand. When you think of it, what is sadder than an old retired knight? Anyway, the detective finally shoots himself with his service revolver. I looked it up on the internet and discovered this type of thing isn't just fiction. It really happens. Retired police have an extremely high suicide rate. In most cases, the cops who do this sad thing have no close family members who might see the warning signs. Many, like you, are divorced. Many have grown children living far away from home. I think of you all alone in your house on Harper Road, Detective Hodges, and I grow concerned. What kind of life do you have now that the thrill of the hunt is behind you? Are you watching a lot of TV? Probably. Are you drinking more? Possibly. Do the hours go by more slowly because your life is now so empty? Are you suffering from insomnia? Gee, I hope not. But I fear that might be the case. You probably need a hobby, so you'll have something to think about instead of the one that got away and how you will never catch me. It would be too bad if you started thinking your whole career had been a waste of time because the fellow who killed all those innocent people slipped through your fingers. I wouldn't want you to start thinking about your gun, but you are thinking of it, aren't you? I would like to close with one final thought from the one that got away. That thought is, fuck you, loser. Just kidding. Very truly yours, the Mercedes Killer. Below this was yet another smile face, and below that, P.S. Sorry about Mrs. Trelawney, but when you turn this letter over to Detective Huntley, tell him not to bother looking at any photos I'm sure the police took at her funeral. I attended, but only in my imagination. My imagination is very powerful. P.P.S. Want to get in touch with me? Give me your feedback? Try Under Debbie's Blue Umbrella. I even got you a username, KermitFrog19. I might not reply, but hey, you never know. P.P.P.S. Hope this letter has cheered you up. 4. Hodges sits where he is for 2 minutes. 4 minutes. 6. 8. Completely still. He holds the letter in his hand, looking at the Andrew Wyeth print on the wall. At last, he puts the pages on the table beside his chair and picks up the envelope. The postmark is right here in the city, which doesn't surprise him. His correspondent wants him to know he's close by. It's part of the taunt. As his correspondent would say, it's part of the fun. New chemicals and computer-assisted scanning processes can pick up excellent fingerprints from paper, but Hodges knows that if he turns this letter into forensics, they will find no prints on it but his. This guy is crazy, but his self-assessment, one crafty perp, is absolutely correct. Only he wrote perk, not perp, and he wrote it twice. Also, wait a minute. What do you mean, when you turn it in? Hodges gets up, goes to the window carrying the letter, and looks out on Harper Road. The Harrison girl puts by on her moped. She's really too young to have one of those things, no matter what the law allows, but at least she's wearing her helmet. The Mr. Tasty truck jangles by. In warm weather, it works the city's east side between schools out and dusk. A little black smart car trundles by. The graying hair of the woman behind the wheel is up in rollers. Or is it a woman? It could be a man wearing a wig and a dress. The rollers would be the perfect final touch, wouldn't they? That's what he wants you to think. But no, not exactly. Not what. It's how. The self-styled Mercedes killer, except he was right, it was really the papers and the TV news that styled him that wants him to think. It's the ice cream man. No, it's the man dressed as a woman in a smart car. It's the guy driving the liquid propane truck. Or the meter reader. How did you spark paranoia like that? It helps to casually let drop that you know more than the ex-detective's address. You know he's divorced and at least imply that he has a kid or kids somewhere. Looking out at the grass now, noticing that it needs cutting. If Jerome doesn't come around pretty soon, Hodges thinks I'll have to call him. Kid or kids? Don't kid yourself. He knows my ex is Corrine and we have one adult child, a daughter named Allison. He knows Allie's 30 and lives in San Francisco. He probably knows she's 5'6" and plays tennis. All that stuff is readily available on the net. These days, everything is. His next move should be to turn this letter over to Pete and Pete's new partner, Isabel Janes. They inherited the Mercedes thing along with a few other danglers when Hodges pulled the pin. Some cases are like idle computers. They go to sleep. This letter will wake up the Mercedes case in a hurry. He traces the progress of the letter in his mind. From the mail slot to the hall floor. From the hall floor to the lazy boy. From the lazy boy to here by the window, where he can now observe the mail truck going back the way it came, Andy Fenster done for the day. From here to the kitchen, where the letter would go into a totally unnecessary glad bag, the kind with a zip top, because old habits are strong habits. Next, to Pete and Isabel. From Pete to forensics for a complete dilation and curettage, where the unnecessariness of the glad bag would be conclusively proved by no prints, no hairs, no DNA of any kind, paper available by the caseload at every Staples and Office Depot in the city, and last but not least, standard laser printing. They may be able to tell what kind of computer was used to compose the letter. About this he can't be sure. He knows little about computers, and when he has trouble with his, he turns to Jerome, who lives handily nearby. And if so, it would turn out to be a Mac or a PC. Big whoop. From forensics, the letter would bounce back to Pete and Isabel, who'd no doubt convene the sort of idiotic cop colloquium you see on BBC crime shows like Luther and Prime Suspect, which his psychopathic correspondent probably loves. This colloquium would be complete with whiteboard and photo enlargements of the letter, maybe even a laser pointer. Hodges watches some of those British crime shows, too, and believes Scotland Yard somehow missed the old saying about too many cooks spoiling the broth. The cop colloquium would accomplish only one thing, and Hodges believes it's what the psycho wants. With 10 or 12 detectives in attendance, the existence of the letter will inevitably leak to the press. The psycho is probably not telling the truth when he says he has no urge to repeat his crime, but of one thing Hodges is completely sure. He misses being in the news. Dandelions are sprouting on the lawn. It is definitely time to call Jerome. Lawn aside, Hodges misses his face around the place. Cool kid. Something else. Even if the psycho is telling the truth about feeling no urge to perpetrate another mass slaughter, unlikely but not out of the question, he's still extremely interested in death. The letter's subtext could not be clearer. Off yourself. You're thinking about it already, so take the next step, which also happens to be the final step. Has he seen me playing with Dad's 38? Seen me putting it in my mouth? Hodges has to admit it's possible. He has never even thought of pulling the shades, feeling stupidly safe in his living room when anybody could have a set of binocs. Or Jerome could have seen. Jerome bopping up the walk to ask about chores, what he is pleased to call chos for hoes. Only if Jerome had seen him playing with that old revolver, he would have been scared to death. He would have said something. Does Mr. Mercedes really masturbate when he thinks about running those people down? In his years on the police force, Hodges has seen things he would never talk about with anyone who has not also seen them. Such toxic memories lead him to believe that his correspondent could be telling the truth about the masturbation, just as he is certainly telling the truth about having no conscience. Hodges has read there are wells in Iceland so deep you can drop a stone down them and never hear the splash. He thinks some human souls are like that. Things like bum fighting are only halfway down such wells. He returns to his lazy boy, opens the drawer in the table, and takes out his cell phone. He replaces it with the 38 and closes the drawer. He speed dials the police department. But when the receptionist asks how she can direct his call, Hodges says, "Oh, damn, I just punched the wrong button on my phone. Sorry to have bothered you."
"No bother, sir," she says with a smile in her voice.
No calls. Not yet. No action of any kind. He needs to think about this. He really, really needs to think about this. Hodges sits looking at his television, which is off on a weekday afternoon for the first time in months. 5. That evening, he drives down to Newmarket Plaza and has a meal at the Thai restaurant. Mrs. Baramuk serves him personally.
"Haven't seen you a long time, Officer Hodges."
"Been cooking for myself since I retired."
"You let me cook. Much better."
When he tastes Mrs. Baramuk's Tom Yum Gang again, he realizes how sick he is of half-raw fried hamburgers and spaghetti with Newman's own sauce. And the Sang Kaya Fog Tong makes him realize how tired he is of Pepperidge Farm coconut cake. If I never eat another slice of coconut cake, he thinks, I could live just as long and die just as happy. He drinks 2 cans of Singa with his meal, and it's the best beer he's had since the Rain Tree retirement party, which went almost exactly as Mr. Mercedes said. There was even a stripper shaking her tail feathers, along with everything else. Had Mr. Mercedes been lurking at the back of the room? As the cartoon possum was wont to say, "It's possible, Muskie. It's possible." At home again, he sits in the lazy boy and takes up the letter. He knows what the next step must be, if he's not going to turn it over to Pete Huntley, that is. But he also knows better than to try doing it after a couple of brewskis. So he puts the letter in the drawer on top of the 38. He never did bother with the glad bag, and gets another beer. The one from the fridge is just an ivory special, the local brand, but it tastes every bit as good as the Singa. When it's gone, Hodges powers up his computer, opens Firefox, and types in "Under Debbie's Blue Umbrella." The descriptor beneath isn't very descriptive. A social site where interesting people exchange interesting views. He thinks of going further, then shuts the computer down. Not that either. Not tonight. He has been going to bed late because that means fewer hours spent tossing and turning, going over old cases and old mistakes, but tonight he turns in early and knows he'll sleep almost at once. It's a wonderful feeling. His last thought.